The Art of Learning, An Inner Journey to Optimal Performance, by Josh Waitzkin, read by the author.
For my mom, my hero, Bonnie Waitzkin. Introduction. One has to investigate the principle in one thing or one event exhaustively. Things in the self are governed by the same principle. If you understand one, you understand the other. For the truth within and the truth without are identical. Erchang Yishu, 11th century. Finals. Tai Chi Chuan Push Hands World Championships. Chin Chuan Stadium, Taipei, Taiwan. December 5th, 2004. 40 seconds before round two, and I'm lying on my back trying to breathe. Pain all through me. Deep breath. Let it go. I won't be able to lift my shoulder tomorrow. It won't heal for over a year, but now it pulses, alive, and I feel the air vibrating around me, the stadium shaking with chants. In Mandarin. Not for me. My teammates are kneeling above me looking worried. They rub my arms, my shoulders, my legs. The bell rings. I hear my dad's voice in the stands. Come on, Josh! Gotta get up. I watch my opponent run to the center of the ring. He screams, pounds his chest. The fans explode. They call him Buffalo. Bigger than me. Stronger. Quick as a cat. But I can take him, if I make it to the middle of the ring without falling over. I have to dig deep. Bring it up from somewhere right now. Our wrists touch. The bell rings. And he hits me like a Mack truck. Who could have guessed it would come to this? Just a few years earlier, I'd been competing around the world in elite chess tournaments. Since I was 8 years old, I had consistently been the highest-rated player for my age in the United States, and my life was dominated by competitions and training regimens designed to bring me into peak form for the next national or world championship. I'd spent the years between ages 15 and 18 in the maelstrom of American media, following the release of the film Searching for Bobby Fischer, which was based in my dad's book about my early chess life. I was known as America's great young chess player, and was told that it was my destiny to follow in the footsteps of immortals like Bobby Fischer and Garry Kasparov, to be world champion. But there were problems. After the movie came out, I couldn't go to a tournament without being surrounded by fans asking for autographs. Instead of focusing on chess positions, I was pulled into the image of myself as a celebrity. Since childhood, I'd treasured the sublime study of chess, the swim through ever-deepening layers of complexity. I could spend hours at a chessboard and stand up from the experience on fire with insight about chess, basketball, the ocean, psychology, love, art. The game was exhilarating and also spiritually calming. It centered me. Chess was my friend. Then, suddenly, the game became alien and disquieting. I recall one tournament in Las Vegas. I was a young international master in a field of 1,000 competitors, including 26 strong grandmasters from around the world. As an up-and-coming player, I had huge respect for the great sages around me. I had studied their masterpieces for hundreds of hours and was awed by the artistry of these men. Before first-round play began, I was seated at my board, deep in thought about my opening preparation, when the public address system announced that the subject of Searching for Bobby Fischer was at the event. A tournament director placed a poster of the movie next to my table, and immediately a sea of fans surged around the ropes, separating the top boards from the audience. As the games progressed, when I rose to clear my mind, young girls gave me their phone numbers and asked me to autograph their stomachs or legs. This might sound like a dream for a 17-year-old boy, and I won't deny enjoying the attention, but professionally it was a nightmare. My game began to unravel. I caught myself thinking about how I looked thinking instead of losing myself in thought. The grandmasters, my elders, were ignored and scowled at me. Some of them treated me like a pariah. I had won 8 national championships and had more fans, public support, and recognition than I could dream of, but none of this was helping my search for excellence, let alone for happiness. At a young age, I came to know that there's something profoundly hollow about the nature of fame. I'd spent my life devoted to artistic growth and was used to the sweaty palm sense of contentment one gets after many hours of intense reflection. This peaceful feeling had nothing to do with external adulation, and I yearned for a return to that innocent, fertile time. I missed just being a student of the game, but there was no escaping the spotlight. I found myself dreading chess, miserable before leaving for tournaments. I played without inspiration and was invited to appear on television shows. I smiled. Then when I was 18 years old, I stumbled upon a little book called The Tao Te Ching, and my life took a turn. I was moved by the book's natural wisdom, and I started delving into other Buddhist and Taoist philosophical texts. I recognized that being at the pinnacle in other people's eyes had nothing to do with quality of life, and I was drawn to the potential for inner tranquility. On October 5th, 1998, I walked into William C.C. Chen's Tai Chi Chuan studio in downtown Manhattan, and I found myself surrounded by peacefully concentrating men and women, floating through a choreographed set of movements. I was used to driven chess players cultivating tunnel vision in order to win the big game, but now the focus was on bodily awareness, as if there were some inner bliss that resulted from mindfully moving slowly in strange ways. I began taking classes, and after a few weeks I found myself practicing the meditative movements for hours at home. Given the complicated nature of my chess life, it was beautifully liberating to be learning in an environment in which I was simply one of the beginners, and something felt right about this art. I was amazed by the way my body pulsed with life when flowing through the ancient steps, as if I were tapping into a primal alignment. My teacher, the world-renowned Grandmaster William C.C. Chen, spent months with me in beginner classes, patiently correcting my movements. In a room with 15 new students, Chen would look into my eyes from 20 feet away, quietly assume my posture, and relax his elbow a half inch one way or another. I would follow his subtle instruction, and suddenly my hand would come alive with throbbing energy, as if he'd plugged me into a soothing electrical current. His insight into body mechanics seemed magical, but perhaps equally impressive was Chen's humility. Here was a man thought by many to be the greatest living Tai Chi master in the world, and he patiently taught first-day novices with the same loving attention he gave his senior students. I learned quickly, and became fascinated with the growth that I was experiencing. Since I was 12 years old, I'd kept journals of my chess study, making psychological observations along the way. Now I was doing the same with Tai Chi. After about 6 months of refining my form, the choreographed movements that are the heart of Tai Chi Chuan, Master Chen invited me to join the push hands class. This was very exciting, my baby steps toward the martial side of the art. In my first session, my teacher and I stood facing each other, each of us with our right leg forward and the backs of our right wrists touching. He told me to push into him, but when I did, he wasn't there anymore. I felt sucked forward, as if by a vacuum. I stumbled, scratched my head. Next, he gently pushed into me, and I tried to get out of the way, but didn't know where to go. Finally, I fell back on old instincts, tried to resist the incoming force, and with barely any contact, Chen sent me flying into the air. Over time, Master Chen taught me the body mechanics of non-resistance. As my training became more vigorous, I learned to dissolve away from attacks while staying rooted to the ground. I found myself calculating less and feeling more. And as I internalized the physical techniques, all the little movements of the Tai Chi meditative form started to come alive to me in push-hands practice. I remember one time in the middle of a sparring session, I sensed a hole in my partner's structure, and suddenly he seemed to leap away from me. He looked shocked and told me that he'd been pushed away, but he hadn't noticed any explosive movement on my part. I had no idea what to make of this, but slowly I began to realize the martial power of my living room meditation sessions. After thousands of slow motion, ever-refined repetitions of certain movements, my body could become that shape instinctively. Somehow in Tai Chi, the mind needed little physical action to have great physical effect. This type of learning experience was familiar to me from chess. My whole life I had studied techniques, principles, and theory until they were integrated into the unconscious. From the outside, Tai Chi and chess couldn't be more different, but they began to converge in my mind. I started to translate my chess ideas into Tai Chi language, as if the two arts were linked by an essential connecting ground. Every day I noticed more and more similarities, until I began to feel as if I were studying chess when I was studying Tai Chi. Once I was giving a 40-board simultaneous chess exhibition in Memphis, and I realized halfway through that I'd been playing all the games as Tai Chi. I wasn't calculating with chess notation or thinking about opening variations. I was feeling flow, filling space left behind, riding waves like I do at sea or in martial arts. This was wild. I was winning chess games without playing chess. Similarly, I'd be in a push-hands competition, and time would seem to slow down enough to allow me to methodically take apart my opponent's structure and uncover his vulnerability, as in a chess game. My fascination with consciousness, study of chess and Tai Chi, love for literature and the ocean, for meditation and philosophy, all coalesced around the theme of tapping into the mind's potential via complete immersion into one and all activities. My growth became defined by barrierlessness. Pure concentration didn't allow thoughts or false constructions to impede my awareness, and I observed clear connections between different life experiences through the common mode of consciousness by which they were perceived. As I cultivated openness to these connections, my life became flooded with intense learning experiences. I remember sitting on a Bermuda cliff one stormy afternoon watching waves pound into the rocks. I was focused on the water trickling back out to sea, and suddenly knew the answer to a chess problem I'd been wrestling with for weeks. Another time, after completely immersing myself in the analysis of a chess position for 8 hours, I had a breakthrough in my Tai Chi, and successfully tested it in class that night. Great literature inspired chess growth. Shooting jump shots on a New York City blacktop gave me insight about fluidity that applied to Tai Chi. Becoming at peace holding my breath 70 feet underwater as a freediver helped me in the time pressure of world championship chess or martial arts competitions. Training in the ability to quickly lower my heart rate after intense physical strain helped me recover between periods of exhausting concentration in chess tournaments. After several years of cloudiness, I was flying free, devouring information, completely in love with learning. Before I began to conceive of this book, I was content to understand my growth in the martial arts in a very abstract manner. I related to my experience with language, like parallel learning and translation of level. I felt as though I had transferred the essence of my chess understanding into my Tai Chi practice, but this didn't make much sense, especially outside of my own head. What does essence really mean anyway? And how does one transfer it from a mental to a physical discipline? These questions became the central preoccupation of my life after I won my first Pushan's National Championship in November of 2000. At the time, I was studying philosophy at Columbia University and was especially drawn to Asian thought. I discovered some interesting foundations for my experience in ancient Indian, Chinese, Tibetan, and Greek texts. Upanishadic essence, Taoist receptivity, Neo-Confucian principle, Buddhist non-duality, and the Platonic forms all seemed to be a bizarre cross-cultural trace of what I was searching for. Whenever I had an idea, I would test it against some brilliant professor, who usually disagreed with my conclusions. Academic minds tend to be impatient with abstract language. When I spoke about intuition, one philosophy professor rolled her eyes and told me the term had no meaning. The need for precision forced me to think about these ideas more concretely. I had to come to a deeper sense of concepts like essence, quality, principle, intuition, and wisdom in order to understand my own experience, let alone have any chance of communicating it. As I struggled for a more precise grasp of my own learning process, I was forced to retrace my steps and remember what had been internalized and forgotten. In both my chess and martial arts lives, there's a method of study that's been critical to my growth. I sometimes refer to it as the study of numbers to leave numbers, or form to leave form. A basic example of this process, which applies to any discipline, can easily be illustrated through chess. A chess student must initially become immersed in the fundamentals in order to have any potential to reach a high level of skill. He or she will learn the principles of endgame, middle game, and opening play. Initially, one or two critical themes will be considered at once, but over time, the intuition learns to integrate more and more principles into a sense of flow. Eventually, the foundation is so deeply internalized that it's no longer consciously considered, but is lived. This process continuously cycles along as deeper layers of the art are soaked in. Very strong chess players will rarely speak of the fundamentals, but these beacons are the building blocks of their mastery. Similarly, a great pianist or violinist doesn't think about individual notes, but hits them all perfectly in a virtuoso performance. In fact, thinking about a C while playing Beethoven's Fifth Symphony could be a real hitch because the flow might be lost. The problem is that if you want to write an instructional chess book for beginners, you have to dig up all the stuff that's buried in your unconscious. I had this issue when I wrote my first book, Attacking Chess. In order to write for beginners, I had to break down my chess knowledge incrementally, whereas for years I've been cultivating a seamless integration of the critical information. The same pattern can be seen when the art of learning is analyzed. Themes can be internalized, lived by, and forgotten. I figured out how to learn efficiently in the brutally competitive world of chess, where a moment without growth spells a front row seat to rivals mercilessly passing you by. Then I intuitively applied my hard-earned lessons to the martial arts. I avoided the pitfalls and tempting divergences that a learner is confronted with, but I didn't really think about them, because the roadmap was deep inside me, just like the chess principles. Since I decided to write this book, I've analyzed myself, taken my knowledge apart, and rigorously investigated my own experience. Speaking to corporate and academic audiences about my learning experience has also challenged me to make my ideas more accessible. Whenever there was a concept or learning technique that I related to in a manner too abstract to convey, I forced myself to break it down into the incremental steps with which I got there. Over time, I began to see the principles that had been silently guiding me, and a systematic methodology of learning emerged. My chess life began in Washington Square Park, in New York's Greenwich Village, and took me on a 16-year roller coaster ride through world championships in America, Romania, Germany, Hungary, Brazil, and India, through every kind of heartache and ecstasy a competitor can imagine. In recent years, my Tai Chi life has become a dance of meditation, an intense martial competition, of pure growth and the observation, testing, and exploration of that learning process. I've currently won 13 Tai Chi Chuan Pushhands National Championship titles, placed third in the 2002 World Championship in Taiwan, and in 2004 I won the Chenghua Cup International in Taiwan, the World Championship of Tai Chi Chuan Pushhands. A lifetime of competition hasn't cooled my ardor to win, but I've grown to love the study and training above all else. After so many years of big games, performing under pressure has become a way of life. Presence under fire hardly feels different from the presence I feel sitting at my computer, typing these sentences. What I've realized is that what I'm best at is not Tai Chi, and it's not chess. What I'm best at is the art of learning. This book is the story of my method. Part 1. The Foundation. Chapter 1. Innocent Moves. I remember the cold, late winter afternoon in downtown New York City, my mother and I holding hands while walking to the playground in Washington Square Park. I was 6 years old, a rough-and-tumble kid with a passion for Spider-Man, sharks, dinosaurs, sports, and driving my parents crazy with mischief. Too much boy, my mom says. I constantly pestered my dad to throw around a football or baseball or to wrestle in the living room. My friends called me waste skin because my knees were often raw from taking spills in the playground or diving for catches. I had an early attraction to the edge, using scraps of wood and cinder blocks from a construction site next door to set up makeshift jump courses for my bike. I refused to wear a helmet until one gorgeous twist ended with a faceplant, and my mom vowed to no longer wear her headgear when horseback riding, unless I followed suit. We had taken this walk dozens of times. I loved to swing around on the monkey bars and become Tarzan, the world, my jungle. But now something felt different. I looked over my shoulder and was transfixed by mysterious figurines set up on a marble chessboard. I remember feeling like I was looking into a forest. The pieces were animals filled with strange potential, as if something dangerous and magical were about to leap from the board. Two park hustlers sat across the table taunting each other. The air was thick with tension, and then the pieces exploded into action, nimble fingers moving with lightning speed and precision, white and black figures darting all over the chessboard, creating patterns. I was pulled into the battlefield, enraptured. Something felt familiar about this game. It made sense. Then a crowd gathered around the table, and I couldn't see anymore. My mom called me, gently pulled on my hand, and we moved on to the playground. A few days later, my mom and I were walking through the same corner of the park when I broke away from her and ran up to an old man with a gray beard who was setting up plastic pieces on one of the marble boards. That day, I had watched a couple of kids playing chess at school, and I thought I could do it. "Want to play?" The old man looked at me suspiciously over his spectacles. My mom apologized, explained that I didn't know how to play chess, but the old man said it was okay. He had children, and he had a little time to kill. My mom tells me that when the game began, my tongue was out and resting on my upper lip, a sure sign that I was either stuffed up or concentrating. I remember the strange sensation of discovering a lost memory. As we moved the pieces, I felt like I had done this before. There was a harmony to this game, like a good song. The old man read a newspaper while I thought about my moves, but after a few minutes he got angry and snapped at my mom, accused her of hustling him. Apparently I was playing well. I had generated an attack by coordinating a few of my pieces, and the old man had to buckle down to fight it off. After a little while, a crowd gathered around the board. People were whispering something about young Fisher. My mom was confused, a little concerned about what had come over her boy. I was in my own world. Eventually, the old man won the game. We shook hands, and he asked me my name. He wrote it on his newspaper and said, "Josh Waitzkin, I'm going to read about you in the paper someday." From that day forward, Washington Square Park became a second home to me, and chess became my first love. After school, instead of hungering for soccer or baseball, I insisted on heading to the park. I'd plop down against some scary-looking dude, put my game face on, and go to war. I loved the thrill of battle. Some days I'd play countless speed chess games, hour after hour, staring through the jungle of pieces, figuring things out, throwing mental grenades back and forth in a sweat. I'd go home with chess pieces flying through my mind, and then I'd ask my dad to take down his dusty wooden set and play with me. Over time, as I became a trusted part of the park scene, the guys took me under their wings, showed me their tricks, taught me how to generate devastating attacks and get into the head of my opponent. I became a protege of the street, hard to rattle, a feisty competitor. It was a bizarre school for a child, a rough crowd of alcoholics, homeless geniuses, wealthy gamblers hooked on the game, junkies, eccentric artists. All diamonds in the rough, brilliant, beat men, lives in shambles, aflame with a passion for chess. Every day, unless it poured or snowed, the 19 marble tables in the southwest corner of Washington Square would fill up with this motley crew. And most days I was there, knocking chessmen over with my short arms, chewing gum, learning the game. Of course, my parents thought long and hard before allowing me to hang out in the park, but I was adamant, and the guys cleaned up their acts when I came to play. The cigarettes and joints were put out, the language was cleaned up, few deals went down. I would sit across from one of my buddies, immediately sweating and focused. My mom told me she saw her little boy become an old man when I played chess. I concentrated so hard she thought her hand would burn if she put it in front of my eyes. It's difficult for me to explain the seriousness I had about chess as a young boy. I guess it was a calling, though I'm still not sure what that means. After a few months, I could already beat a number of the guys who'd been playing for decades. When I lost a game, one of my friends would give me a piece of advice. "Josh, you laid back too long. He got comfortable. You gotta go after him, make him scared." Or, "Josh, my man, sometimes you got a castle, get your king to safety. Check yourself before you wreck yourself." Then I'd hit the clock, buckle down, and try again. Each loss was a lesson, each win a thrill. Every day, pieces of the puzzle fell together. Whenever I showed up to play, big crowds would gather around the table. I was a star in this little world, and while all the attention was exciting for a child, it was also a challenge. I learned quickly that when I thought about the people watching, I played badly. It was hard for a 6-year-old ham to ignore throngs of adults talking about him. But when well focused, I seemed to hover in an in-between state where the intensity of the chess position mixed with the rumble of voices, traffic noises, ambulance sirens, all in an inspiring swirl that fueled my mind. Some days I could concentrate more purely in the chaos of Washington Square Park than in the quiet of my family's living room. Other days I'd look around at everybody, get caught up in their conversations, and play terribly. I'm sure it was frustrating for my parents watching my early discovery of chess. There was no telling whether I'd chew gummy bears, smile, joke, and hang my pieces, or buckle down into another world of intensity. One Saturday afternoon, there was a tall figure standing in the crowd while I played speed chess against my friend Jerry. I noticed him, but then fell back into the game. A couple of hours later, the man approached my father and introduced himself as Bruce Pendolfini, a master-level player and a chess teacher. Bruce told my dad I was very gifted and offered to teach me. It turns out that my dad recognized Bruce as the man who did television commentary with Shelby Lyman during the historic Bobby Fischer versus Boris Spassky World Championship match in 1972. The match had revolutionized chess. It was a Cold War face-off pitting the Soviet world champion, along with his team of 100 coaches and trainers, against the brash, renegade American challenger, who did all his preparation alone, in a room, without a view. Fischer was a combination of James Dean and Greta Garbo, and America was fascinated. There were huge political implications to this contest of great thinkers. Increasingly, as the match unfolded, it became perceived as the embodiment of the Cold War. Henry Kissinger called Bobby with support. Politicians on both sides followed each game closely. The world watched breathless as Shelby and Bruce brought chess to life on television with their human, down-home analysis of the games. When Fischer won the match, he became an international celebrity, and chess exploded across America. Suddenly, the game stood shoulder to shoulder with basketball, football, baseball, hockey. Then in 1975, Fischer disappeared instead of defending his title. Chess in America receded into the shadows. Ever since, the American chess world has been searching for a new Bobby Fischer, someone to bring the sport back into the limelight. Shelby and Bruce had captured my dad's imagination 20 years before, and now it was a bit surreal that Bruce was offering to teach his 6-year-old bowling ball of a child. I was nonplussed. Chess was fun, and the guys in the park were my buddies. They were teaching me fine. Why should I have any more coaches? I was private about chess, as if it were an intimate fantasy world. I had to trust someone to let them into my thought process. And Bruce had to overcome this shield before the work could begin. Our first lessons were anything but orthodox. We hardly studied chess. Bruce knew it was more important for us to get to know one another, to establish a genuine camaraderie. So we talked about life, sports, dinosaurs, things that interested me. Whenever the discussion turned to chess, I was stubborn about my ideas and refused to receive formal instruction. I insisted on some bad habits I'd learned in the park. For example, bringing out my queen early. This is a typical beginner's error. The queen is the most powerful piece on the chessboard, so people want to bring her into the action right away. Against unskilled opponents who can't parry simple attacks, this strategy works marvelously. The problem is that since the queen can't be traded for any of the opponent's pieces without significant loss, she can be chased all over the board while the other guy naturally brings his less valuable but quite potent warriors into play, and simultaneously swats aside the primitive threats of the lone queen. Logical enough. But I resisted because I'd won so many early games with the wandering queen. Bruce couldn't convince me with words. He had to prove it. Bruce decided we should have knockdown, drag-out speed chess matches, like the ones I was used to in the park. Whenever I made a fundamental error, he would mention the principle I had violated. If I refused to budge, he'd proceed to take advantage of the error, until my position fell apart. Over time, Bruce earned my respect, as I saw the correctness of his ideas. My queen started to wait until the moment was right. I learned to develop my pieces to control the center, to prepare attacks systematically. Once he had won my trust, Bruce taught me by allowing me to express myself. The main obstacle to overcome was my impetuosity. I was a talented kid with good instincts who'd been beating up on street hustlers who lacked classical training. Now it was time to slow me down and properly arm my intuition, but Bruce had a fine line to tread. He had to teach me to be more disciplined without dampening my love for chess or suppressing my natural voice. Many teachers have no feel for this balance and try to force their students into cookie-cutter molds. I've run into quite a few egomaniacal instructors like this over the years and have come to believe that their method is profoundly destructive for students in the long run. In any case, it certainly wouldn't have worked for me. I'm sure I was a tough kid to teach. My parents raised a willful child. Even as a young boy, I was encouraged to take part in the spirited dinner party debates about art and politics in my family's living room. I was taught to express my opinion and to think about the ideas of others, not to follow authority blindly. Fortunately, Bruce's educational philosophy fit my character perfectly. He didn't present himself as omniscient, and he handled himself as more of a guide in my development than as an authority. If I disagreed with him, we'd have a discussion, not a lecture. Bruce slowed me down by asking questions. Whenever I made an important decision, good or bad, he'd ask me to explain my thought process. Were there other ways to accomplish the same aim? Had I looked for my opponent's threats? Did I consider a different order of operations? Bruce didn't patronize me. Some teachers rebel so far away from being authoritarian that they praise all their little players' decisions, good or bad. Their intention is to build confidence. But instead, they discourage objectivity, encourage self-indulgence, and perhaps most destructively, they create a dishonest relationship between instructor and pupil that any bright child can sense. When I made a bad move, Bruce asked me what my idea was, and then helped me discover how I could have approached the decision-making process differently. Much of the time in our lessons was spent in silence, with us both thinking. Bruce didn't want to feed me information, but to help my mind carve itself into maturity. Over time, in his coaxing, humorous, and understatedly firm manner, Bruce gave me a foundation of critical chess principles and a systematic understanding of analysis and calculation. While the new knowledge was valuable, the most important factor in these first months of study was that Bruce nurtured my love for chess, and he never let technical material smother my innate feeling for the game. During these early months of work with Bruce, we'd meet once or twice a week in my family's apartment, sometimes early mornings, sometimes after school. Most other days I'd go to Washington Square and duke it out with my friends in the park. As a 6- and 7-year-old boy, I had two powerful currents to my chess education, and the key was to make them coexist peacefully. The street-tough competitor had to fuse with the classically trained, patient player that Bruce was inspiring. Though when very young I was periodically reluctant about real chess work, I loved the sublime beauty of old world championship games I studied with Bruce. Sometimes sitting in silence and calculating an endgame position for 20 minutes would thrill me to the core. But other times, such serious thinking would bore me, and I'd hunger to play speed chess with my buddies, to attack, to be a little reckless and create beautiful combinations. The park was fun. I was a child, after all. Despite significant outside pressure, my parents and Bruce decided to keep me out of tournaments until I'd been playing chess for a year or so, because they wanted my relationship to the game to be about learning and passion first, and competition a distant second. My mother and Bruce were particularly ambivalent about exposing me to the harsh pressures of competitive chess. They gave me some extra months of innocence, for which I'm grateful. When I finally started playing in scholastic tournaments soon after my 7th birthday, the games felt easy. Children my own age didn't fashion complicated attacks and defenses like the guys in the park did, and they'd crumble under pressure. Some of the kids were armed with dangerous opening traps, memorized variations that could lead to early advantages, so I often came out of the opening down a pawn or two, but then they didn't have a chance. For me, competitive chess was not about perfection. It was more of a mental prize fight, with two opponents trading advantages, momentum going one way and then the other. My friends in Washington Square were valiant competitors. You could never count them out. In fact, they were most dangerous when on the ropes. Many very talented kids expected to win without much resistance. When the game was a struggle, they were emotionally unprepared. I thrived under adversity. My style was to make the game complex and then work my way through the chaos. When the position was wild, I had huge confidence. Bruce and I also spent a lot of time studying endgames, where the board is nearly empty and high-level principles combined with deep calculations to create fascinating battles. While my opponents wanted to win in the openings right off the bat, I guided positions into complicated middle games and abstract endings. So as the game went on, their confidence shrank, and I became a predator. Noticing these tendencies, Bruce started calling me Tiger. He still calls me Tiger today. My first year of competitive chess was smooth sailing. I felt unbeatable when matched up with kids my age, and the combination of street toughness and classical education proved devastating for my opponents. Perhaps the most decisive element of my game was the way my style on the board was completely in sync with my personality as a child. I was unhindered by internal conflict, a state of being that I've come to see as fundamental to the learning process. Bruce and the park guys had taught me how to express myself through chess, and so my love for the game grew every day. As the months went by, I piled up win after win, and my national rating skyrocketed. I'd show up at a tournament and the kids were terrified of me, which felt strange. I was, after all, a young child who was scared of the dark and loved Scooby-Doo. More than once, opponents started weeping at the board before the game had even begun. I felt bad for them, but also empowered. Before I knew it, I was the highest-ranked player for my age in the country. The next step was the national championship, to be held in Charlotte, North Carolina. The guys in the park were buzzing with excitement, showing me more and more weapons, honing my game. I was the hands-down favorite to win the primary division, kindergarten through third grade. There wasn't a doubt in my mind. Chapter 2. Losing to Win. Primary School National Chess Championship, Charlotte, North Carolina, May 5th, 1985. Last round, board 1. Winner takes the title. My opponent and I were set up on a solitary table, in front of an unmanned camera that would relay the position to press, coaches, and anxiety-ridden parents in the hotel lobby. The rest of the competitors, over 500 of the country's top young chess players, who had come to battle for the national championships, faced off on long rows of chess boards, filling up the rest of the tense playing hall. The top board is a throne, or a prison, depending on how you look at it. Everyone dreams of getting there, but then you arrive and find yourself all alone, trapped on a pedestal, with a bullseye on your forehead. Entering the tournament, I was the man to beat. I knew teams had been gunning for me, spending months of preparation on treacherous opening traps designed specifically to catch me off guard. But I had already rolled over my first 6 opponents, giving up only 1 draw. I felt unbeatable when matched up against kids my age. They couldn't touch me. Little did I know that my opponent was a well-armed genius. His name was David Arnett. At 3 years old, he'd memorized the New York City subway map. At 6, he was the top first grader in the country, and the best chess player at the prestigious Dalton School, which was coached by Svetozar Jovanovich, a legend in scholastic chess who had taught many young champions. Jovanovich had given David a classical chess education, and a sense for competitive discipline to rival my own. Soon after this game, Dave and I would become best friends, but right now he was just a buck-toothed little blonde kid who looked petrified. On the 3rd move of the game, Dave made a strange decision, allowing me to capture his king pawn with my knight. I should have taken some time to look for traps, but I moved too quickly. Then he was all over me, bringing his queen into a dangerous attacking position, chasing my overextended knight, who had nowhere safe to hide. I'd been stupid to grab the pawn. Now this smart little kid was going after my king, and I was fighting for my life. I can see my 8-year-old self as the game slipped away, sitting at the board, sweat beginning to flow, goosebumps rising, my heart picking up speed, hungry stares of envious rivals sitting at nearby chessboards, the eerie rustling silence of the playing hall, the fragility of so many dreams. I wasn't a Superman. I was a child who slept in my parents' bedroom because of terrible nightmares, now competing with the world on my shoulders, and everything falling apart. I had a choice of completely self-destructing or losing some material, regrouping, and then trying to fight back. I'd done this countless times at Washington Square, but being on the ropes against a kid was new to me. I had dealt with the pressures of being the favorite at the Nationals by puffing myself up with a sense of invincibility. Confidence is critical for a great competitor, but overconfidence is brittle. We're too smart for ourselves in such moments. We sense our mortality like a cancer beneath the bravado. And when things start to go out of control, There's little real resilience to fall back on. When the game was over, I was stunned, reeling from being so close to winning my first national championship and then letting it go, self-destructing, falling apart. Was I a loser? Had I let my parents down? What about the guys in the park? Bruce, my friends at school. How could I have lost? One of the problems with being too high is there's a long way to fall. Had I fallen in my own eyes, or also in the eyes of those around me? After trying so hard, was there worth that side of winning? An 8-year-old is hardly prepared to deal with such loaded issues, and I was very fortunate to have a family with the ability to keep, or at least regain, a bit of perspective in times of extreme intensity. We went fishing. The ocean has been a huge part of my life since the womb, literally. When my mom was 5 months pregnant, we were at sea, trolling for blue marlin and 10-foot Gulfstream rollers. Some of my earliest memories are from the dock of my family's little house on mosquito-ridden South Bimini Island, fishing for snappers, feeding moray eels, swatting away bugs at night while chumming for sharks. Growing up, I knew that come summertime, we'd head off to sea no matter what else was happening in our lives, what crisis was looming, what tournaments I was missing, how out of context or absurd our ocean trips might have felt at the moment of departure. I've come to understand that these little breaks from the competitive intensity of my life have been and still are an integral part of my success. Times at sea are periods of renewal, coming together with my family, being with nature, putting things back in perspective. I'm able to let my conscious mind move away from my training and to gain creative new angles on the next steps of my growth. These trips are a far cry from luxurious vacations. Actually, they're non-stop manual labor, sweating in the engine room trying to coax an old generator back to life, working the cockpit in the hot sun, keeping the boat together in angry squalls, navigating through big seas, living right on the edge. The boating life has also been a wonderful training ground for performance psychology. Living on the water requires constant presence and the release of control. A boat is always moving with the sea, lurching beneath your feet, and the only way to survive is to sink into rhythm with the waves and be ready for anything. I learned at sea that virtually all situations can be handled as long as presence of mind is maintained. On the other hand, if you lose your calm when crisis hits 70 miles from land or while swimming with big sharks, there's no safety net to catch you. There have been many years when leaving my New York life felt like career suicide. My chess rivals were taking lessons and competing at every weekend tournament, while I was on a boat crashing through big waves. But I would come back with new ideas and a full tank of energy and determination. The ocean has always healed me, brought me back to life when I've needed it. And as an 8-year-old child in the midst of an existential crisis, I needed it. My parents, baby sister, and I left Fort Lauderdale on the ebb tide, our 24-foot Blackfin, a wonderful old fishing boat that carried us through many summer adventures in high seas until she blew up and sank when I was 12. 57 miles east-southeast was Bimini, an island that was like home to me. I can still see her coming into sight through my childhood eyes, those hazy first trees like a miracle after a long ocean crossing. We didn't talk about chess for weeks. We fished, dove in warm, crystal-clear water, trolled the Gulf Stream, breathed in the beautiful southern air. I rediscovered myself as a child, ran around the island with my friends Kier and Kino, passed countless hours with my head hanging off our rickety old dock, handline dangling in the water, watching the fish dart around. On rainy evenings, my mom and I would take our dog Brownie and go into the jungle hunting for giant land crab. My family reconnected as human beings outside of the mad swirl of scholastic chess. I was devastated, but slowly my parents revived my boyish enthusiasm for life. In painful times, my mom has always been an anchor, holding everything together until the clouds roll by. When I was a child, she'd press her soft cheek against mine, reminding me that I didn't always have to be so tough. I didn't have to tell her how I felt. She knew. My mother is the greatest person I've ever known. She's a brilliant, loving, compassionate woman with a wisdom that to this day blows my mind. Quietly powerful, infinitely supportive, absurdly selfless. She's always encouraged me to follow my heart, even when it led me far away or to seemingly bizarre pursuits. She's also incredibly brave, sometimes to my dismay, facing down 400-pound sharks in deep ocean, handlining leaping blue marlin, taming wild 2,000-pound stallions, breaking up street fights, keeping my dad and me in line. She's been a constant balancing force throughout all the madness of our lives, lifting us when we were down, providing perspective when we got too swept away by ambition, giving a hug when tears flowed. My mom is my hero. Without her, the whole thing falls apart. My father is a different type of character. He's a loyal, emotional, eccentric, think Woody Allen meets Larry David with an adventurous spin, devoted dad who's been my best friend since day one. I can't imagine how many hours we've spent together, playing basketball, throwing around footballs and baseballs, scouring ocean horizons for birds above schooling fish, traveling to chess tournaments, then martial arts championships all over the world. We've been an elite team since I was 6 years old, and subsequently have been joined at the hip in our ambitions and, to a certain extent, our emotions. No matter how much perspective we tried to maintain, our senses of well-being often fluctuated with my competitive results. There was no way around this. After winning huge tournaments, all was well, and the sky was the limit. When I was playing badly, everything could look bleak, and our dreams absurd. It's true that I played with the knowledge that my dad's heart was on the line side by side with my own. But I also knew that he would love me regardless of the outcome. There's little question that some psychologists would frown upon such codependence between father and son. But when you're pursuing the pinnacle, sometimes limits must be pushed. There are big games, climactic moments, final surges, where you dig for energy and inspiration wherever you can find it, and pick up the pieces later. One thing is for sure. Through thick and thin, my dad has always been in my corner, 100%. After a month on Bimini, my pop got restless and arranged a match between me and the best chess player on the island. He was worried that I was taking too long away from the game, and also he was just itching to see me play again. I wasn't so eager for the match, preferring to fish with my handline and go diving for lobster. Chess was still a burden to me, but the idea of the championship of Bimini sounded harmless and amusing. We tracked down the guy and faced off in a bar. He had gold teeth and a huge gold necklace hanging down over the board, remnants of a drug-smuggling past. It took me a few minutes to get into the games, but then I came alive, the old love trickling back. I recall the feeling of inevitability, like chess was part of me, not to be denied. Something steeled in my 8-year-old self that summer. I wouldn't go out a loser. When I got home in the fall, Bruce was preoccupied with book deadlines and had no time for me. He canceled lesson after lesson, which felt like a terrible slap in the face. I had lost, and now my teacher didn't like me. The equation was simple. When we did meet, his mind was elsewhere, and the lessons were technical and alienating. Maybe he was busy, but I was a kid in need. I also transferred from the Little Red Schoolhouse to the Dalton School on the Upper East Side of Manhattan. The transition was difficult. Instead of a few blocks from home, school was now a long bus ride away. I missed my friends at Little Red and felt out of place with all the rich kids at Dalton. I remember the first time a couple of us went over to my new friend's apartment uptown, and I walked into what seemed like a palace. There were doormen and maids and chandeliers hanging from duplexed ceilings. I was confused by all this stuff and began to wonder if my family was somehow inferior. I'm still ashamed of the memory of asking my dad to park around the corner when he came to pick me up, so my friends wouldn't see our beat-up green Plymouth that had a shot suspension and an alarming habit of jumping lanes in the West Side Drive. I was a mess. My chess life had fallen apart, my teacher didn't like me anymore, I missed my friends, and my family didn't have a doorman or a fancy car. On top of all this, a pretty girl I had a crush on at school had developed the habit of hitting me over the head with her shoes, which I didn't realize until she told me many years later was a sign that she shared my feelings. I was a child in transition, and I needed some help getting through. A few weeks into the fall, Bruce saw that rushing through mechanical chess analysis was not what I needed, and so he took a step back and reconceived our chess life. Our lessons now included raucous speed chess sessions with breaks to toss a football outside. We began to laugh and connect as human beings as we had in our first sessions years before. I went back to playing in Washington Square with my old buddies. The game became less haunted. I was having fun again. Then Bruce and I went to work. We plunged deep into the heart of the art, analyzing complex middle game and end game positions, studying the classics, developing my technical understanding. We started doing arduous visualization work, playing blindfold chess games, and working through long variations in our heads without moving the pieces. Chess was different now. During those summer months when I questioned everything and decided to come back strong, I arrived at a commitment to chess that was about much more than fun and glory. It was about love and pain and passion and pushing myself to overcome. It might sound absurd, but I believe that year from 8 to 9 was the defining period of my life. I responded to heartbreak with hard work. I was self-motivated and moved by a powerful resolve. While a young boy, I had been all promise. I only knew winning because I was better than all the other children, and there was no pressure competing against adults. Now there was the knowledge of my mortality. I had lost to a kid, and there were other children who were also dangerous rivals. I was still the highest-rated player for my age in the country, and when I went to tournaments, there was immense pressure. If I won, it was no big deal. But if I lost, it felt like the sky would fall. There was one boy who was particularly alarming. His name was Jeff Sauer. He was a scary child, small, often bald and barefoot. He didn't go to school, and his father had him studying chess 12 hours a day. When he played, Jeff would chant, "Kill, kill, kill," under his breath. The kid was all aggression, brilliant, a powerhouse over the board. When I had just gotten back from my summer away, I arrived at the Manhattan Chess Club for a lesson with Bruce, and Jeff was sitting there playing a regular. He approached me with a challenge, which I accepted. I was rusty and not expecting much of a game. He blew me away. A couple months later, I went back to the Manhattan and returned the favor with a huge crowd surrounding the board. After I beat him, I heard that he sat crying in a corner for hours. Terrible. This was a bitter rivalry between children, and it felt like the end of the earth. I spent many afternoons studying chess in my room, alone. Sometimes my dad tried to distract me, lure me away to play football or basketball, and I would have none of it. There was too much on the line. My parents worried that I'd become too serious about chess, and my dad periodically told me that it was okay if I wanted to quit. They didn't understand that quitting was not an option. As the Nationals approached, my training got even more intense. I sharpened myself in the park, soaked in the street's smart advice of my hustler friends, and did more and more serious work with Bruce. I knew Sauer was spending every waking minute working with grandmasters, honing his razor-sharp game. He was a machine, annihilating strong adults in speed chess sessions, and then humiliating them with his disdain. One day he showed up at the park when I wasn't there, and all my buddies told him I was better. He laughed and said Josh is a putz. They taunted him until he left my home turf. The New York chess scene was divided between his camp and mine. This was not child's play anymore. The Nationals were held in Charlotte, North Carolina. I traveled to the tournament with my parents, baby sister Katya, and Bruce. This was the first tournament to which Bruce had ever come with me. He wasn't a competitor at heart, and was deeply conflicted about children tearing each other apart under such pressure. I don't really blame him. Three close friends of mine from Little Red also came to hang out at the tournament with their parents. They weren't really chess players. This was more of a vacation for them. I was deadly serious. I played my games on the first board, isolated from the rest of the children once more. My parents waited in the hotel lobby, watching my game on a video monitor with throngs of other nervous moms and dads. My first round was difficult, but then I cruised through the field, winning my first six games. Going into the last round, Jeff Sauer and I had the only two perfect scores. I had harder pairings throughout the event, so if we drew the game, I would win on tiebreaks. But no one was thinking draw. Jeff was the only kid I was afraid of. Rumor was that he, his father, and sister had been sleeping in their car throughout the tournament. Between rounds, he would sit on the floor, hugging his skinny knees and scowling at anyone who tried to speak to him. He had contempt for other kids, called them ugly putzes, and smirked when approached. It would be easy to vilify him, but Jeff was a child dealt certain cards. His father was a brutal authoritarian, a messianic figure who channeled his crazy energy and ideas into creating the perfect chess machine. Although we never really connected on a personal level, I had great respect for Jeff. He loved the game and worked at it harder than anyone I knew. This would be war. He had the white pieces, a small advantage, white moves first. It was magnified by our particular matchup. I had done a lot of preparation on the white side of my opening repertoire and was less confident with black. He started the game with tremendous aggression, coming straight after me with a very dangerous central pawn storm against my King's Indian defense. I had never seen this variation before. He moved quickly, playing with terrifying confidence, and I was on the ropes from the start. His central pawn phalanx seemed to be devouring me, pushing me back before the game even began. He bristled with cockiness and seemed to mock me, implying that I had no right to sit at his chessboard. My chances looked slim right off the bat. Early in the middle game, I lost a pawn, and then I tried to slow down his initiative by trading some pieces. This is risky. When you're down material, exchanging pieces increases your opponent's advantage. Consider how the ratio of 5 to 4 compares to 4 to 3, 3 to 2, 2 to 1, 1 to 0. As pieces come off the chessboard, a small material edge can gradually become overwhelming. But I loved the endgame. I headed for it like a safe house. When we traded queens, Jeff seemed to snarl at me. He was an absolute killer, and he had me by the throat. After 3 hours, the tournament hall was empty as we reached the end of the game. We were alone but for the television camera that was broadcasting to the hotel lobby, where hundreds of people were gathered around the monitor, watching and wondering which little kid would be champ and which would be crushed. The silence was suffocating. Maybe that was just my position. I had a knight and 5 pawns against his bishop and 6 pawns. It looked hopeless. I remember wrestling with the demons of the previous year's heartbreaker while I searched for a way out. Nothing there. I went to the bathroom and cried. Then I washed my face, steeled myself, buckled down, and went back to the board. It was as if I was trapped in dark jungle, stuck in the underbrush, starving, bleeding, and suddenly there was a little light. I'll never forget the feeling when I sensed my potential escape. Often in chess, you feel something is there before you find it. The skin suddenly perks up. Senses heighten like an animal feeling danger or prey. The unconscious alerts the conscious player that there is something to be found, and then the search begins. I started calculating, putting things together. Slowly the plan crystallized in my mind. I had to take my knight out of play and give up my remaining pawns to set up a long combination that would leave just two kings on the board. A completely counterintuitive idea. I found moves that were far beyond my years to save that game, and I'm not really sure how I did it. We drew the game and I became national champion. I walked into the playing hall in a daze and was hit by a mob of cheering kids and parents who'd been sucked into the drama of the battle. One coach, an international master, asked me why I had made a certain decision in the middle game, and I had no idea what he was talking about. Chess was already a world away. The humanity of the moment was overwhelming. I watched Jeff slip around the crowd and approach his father, who rejected him with a cold stare. It was awful.